Welcome back. If this is your second in the two-part session, and if this is your first in the two-part session, then welcome back anyway. Happy to have you join us. I'm Rabbi Avi Strasberg. We're continuing on in our second parter on Sota, on the Sota ritual. So just to remind you in a second where we've been and where we're going, we started on Monday looking at the Sota ritual as it's described in the Torah, the Sota ritual that says if a woman sequesters herself and is unfaithful to her husband, or if just a wave of jealousy comes over the husband, then he should bring her to the priest, and the priest will uncover her hair and force her to drink these bitter waters that has sort of the name of God and this particular text from the Torah written in it, and then the ritual will prove her innocence or her guilt. If she's innocent, then she'll go free, and perhaps she'll even be more fertile. That's not in the Torah itself, but some later we talked about that, and later commentaries talk about that. And if she's not, then this thing will happen that we're not totally sure how to understand, but her belly will distend, her thigh will sag, there'll be some sort of inner thing. It's unclear whether this is just she'll be made infertile or sort of something more, could it be death by the ritual? It's not totally clear what there is, but there's some sort of physical effect that's going to prove her guilt. And then from the Torah, we moved on to the Mishnah. And what we saw in the Mishnah is sort of two, what I would say identify as two different tensions. On one hand, the Mishnah was very clear. The Mishnah wanted to, in some sense, slow down the process, make it harder for this ritual to be practiced by requiring a two-step process of witnessing. That first, the husband had to have witnesses to the warning that he gave her, that there had to be a warning where he warns her, don't be alone with this person. And that has to be witnessed by at least two witnesses. And then there has to be a second stage of witnessing where when she's actually alone with the person, as we said, the door to the hotel room closes, that also has to have witnesses. And it's debatable whether that needs two witnesses or if the husband can just witness it themselves. But either way, the Mishnah is trying to, it seems like, make it harder to actually put this ritual in practice and slow it down so that it can't be just ruach kina, a wave of jealousy comes over the husband, and then he immediately says, taking you to the priest, that there has to be more of a formal sort of process of due warning and witnessing. And on the other hand, something that we saw, or that I would identify in the Mishnah, is that it feels like in a sense the Mishnah makes, to the extent that the ritual, you might have read it as problematic or humiliating in the Torah, which I would, the Mishnah actually I think makes it more painful by making it, instead of just that the woman is being brought to stand before the priest and being made to stand before God, she's being made to stand now all the community who wants to see her, the community comes out. It seems like women are specifically being encouraged to come out so that they'll see where wantonness and lewdness will lead them. It becomes a very public ritual. The Mishnah is more specific with all the sort of uncovering and why she's being uncovered. It's not just that the priest uncovers her hair. He uncovers her because she uncovered herself. He exposes her because she exposed herself. He rips her clothing so that her chest is showing, unless, of course, she's too attractive, and that would be a problem. That the witnesses say things to her, that the judges say things to her that aren't fit for her to hear, fit for her, that there's sort of like this threatening and humiliation that goes on. So that on one hand, the Mishnah is, it seems like, concerned that just on a whim of jealousy, the husband will take his wife off to the priest and trying to slow down that process. On the other hand, the ritual itself becomes more public and potentially more exposing, and in that way, more humiliating or degrading to the woman. So that's where we were on Monday. I want to, in our session today, we're going to really be in two very different modes. In our first mode, I want to make sure that we spend some time seeing the Gemara responding to the Mishnah. We're going to see in the Gemara is going to lay out three very distinct positions held by different rabbis, in which it is straight up asur. It's straight up forbidden for a man to subject his wife to the Sota ritual, which is amazing that you could have someone, multiple rabbis saying, this thing that the Torah tells us to do, it's actually a sore. Don't do it. It's actually forbidden. This Sota ritual in the Torah, we're so uncomfortable with it. It's so problematic that we're saying it's forbidden. So we're going to see that position outlined in the Gemara, that it's actually a sore. It's forbidden. We're going to see it outlined that it's reshut, that it's permitted, meaning you neither have to do it or you don't have to do it. that it's on the husband to decide whether or not he wants to bring his wife before the priest, but he can choose. And we're also going to see a position that it's chova on the husband, that he's obligated. If he suspects his wife of cheating, that he has, in fact, an obligation to society to bring his wife forward and subject her to the ritual. And so just even in terms of naming that, I just really want to emphasize part of what we're going to see in the Gemara today is that the rabbinic tradition is not all one voice. It is very multivocal. And in the same way that us in this class, when we read the ritual in the Torah, we might have different responses and feelings to it. The rabbis themselves, when they learn the ritual in the Torah, had their own different responses and feelings that led them to either think it's forbidden to perform, it's permitted, but you do or don't have to, or it's in fact chova, it's obligatory. So that's where we're going. So we're in Masechet Sota. We have an entire tractate devoted to the Sota. On 2a, this is the very beginning. Hamekane de'avad in la'tchila lo. So the Gemara first out wants to note the Mishnah, and we saw this in the Mishnah, when the Mishnah talks about the one who subjects his wife to this ritual, it uses the language of hamekane le'ishto, the one who is jealous of his wife. And we talked about, whereas in the Torah, the word mekane, I think quite literally means the one who is jealous of his wife. Mekane becomes the process of formal warning. The warning that a husband gives his wife is called a kinui. So the one who is jealous of his wife, or the one who formally warns his wife, that's the language that the Mishnah uses, hamekane l'ishto. And the Gemara picks up on that opening word and says, the way that the Mishnah says hamekane, the one who warns his wife, it sounds like from that de'avad, after the fact, the one who warns his wife, this is what should happen. After the fact, it is permissible, meaning like it's not an ideal situation, de'avad, it's not an ideal situation to subject your wife to this ritual and give her the warning. But if you've already given her the warning, then here's what happens, lehatchila lo. But from the get-go, no, we don't actually want you warning your wife because we don't actually want this ritual happening. So we're so suddenly the warning of one's wife and the introduction of the possibility of the sota ritual becomes a de'avad lehatchila situation where we're saying, b'de'avad, if you have already gone ahead and given your wife the warning, then you've set these steps in process and here's what you do. And then you bring her to the priest and whatever, but that's not ideal. We don't want you warning your wife. We don't want this ritual to happen. Lehatchila, from the get-go, if you haven't yet warned her, don't go ahead and do it. And so the Gemara just straight off the bat reads the language of the Mishnah is saying, not so fast. We might not want this warning to happen. Hamekane de'evad, after the fact, if you already warned her, fine. Lehatchila, if you haven't warned her, that's not what we want. Don't. Kasavar tana didan asor lekanot. And so therefore, it seems that our Tana, our teacher of this Mishnah, holds that it is forbidden to warn one's wife. This is a major change. You have the Torah prescribing, I would say, the Sota ritual for what a husband should do or can do if he suspects his wife of cheating. You have the Mishnah add in the layers of warning, and we want to slow this process down and make sure there's a two-step process of warning. And now all of a sudden you have the Gemara saying, well, the fact that it says, well, one who warns his wife, that sounds like after the fact, you've already given the warning, but we don't actually want you doing that. That's problematic, because once you warn your wife, you then force yourself to have to go through this process of subjecting your wife to this ritual. Really, from the get-go, we're saying the person who authored this Mishnah holds that it should be, or it is forbidden to give this warning. If you go ahead and do it, then here's what happens. Rav Shmuel Bar Yitzchak says, when Reish Lakish would introduce his discussion of the Torah passage of Sota, he would say, heaven matches a woman to a man only according to his actions. As is it stated, for the rod of wickedness shall not rest upon the lot of the righteous. Sort of amazing. We get a window into like when Reish Lakish was teaching Sota to his students, before he went and just dove in talking about Sota and the jealous husband and the adulterous wife, he would start out by saying that heaven only matches a woman according to his man's actions. Meaning like you don't just get an adulterous wife with some good righteous man, that the man gets the woman that matches sort of like his integrity and his honor. the rod of wickedness shall not rest upon the letter of the righteous. If the man was so righteous in himself, he wouldn't have been matched up with a cheating, adulterous wife. Sort of amazing that you have Reish Lakish, sort of some awareness of when you're going about, when Reish Lakish is going about teaching the sensitive material of Sota, he doesn't just start in talking about the adulterous wife, but he first wants to say, listen, guys, there's no such thing as righteous men and cheating wives. Actually, it's sort of cheating wives and cheating husbands or immoral behavior. They actually go together. And that responsibility, to the extent that there's immoral behavior happening in a relationship, that responsibility is shared between the husband and wife. It's not that the husband is righteous and is just pointing his finger at the adulterous wife. So just from the get-go of the Gemara, we start out having, okay, we're saying there's a process of warning, but we don't even want you getting to the stage of warning. We don't even want to get, because once you get to the stage of warning, then you're trapped. Then you have to actually go through with it. We're saying it's forbidden to warn. And you get this sort of amazing intro. When Reish Lakish would teach the practice of Sota, he wanted to make it clear that we're not just pointing the finger at the wife, that this morality goes together. I want to just read on a little bit more, and then I want to stop to hear your comments and thoughts. Then we're getting, I've skipped a little bit of the Gemara here, as you can see by my ellipses, but we're going to go on and hear a little bit more Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish, the same Reish Lakish that before teaching this sensitive material of Sota, he would give a little framing and context. He would then say, Amar Reish Lakish, ma lashon kinui. Where does the language of kinui, of this warning that a husband gives his wife, where does it come from? It's a devar hamatil kina beina levein acharim. Kinui, this warning, is something that casts jealousy between her, the wife, and between others. Or kina, meaning that it casts sort of like a negative feeling, an anger, between her and between others. That built into this word kinui is this word of anger, is this word of distancing. This warning that you give to the wife is going to distance the wife from others, meaning other men. Alma kasavar kinui al piatsmo. And so therefore we assume the fact that Reish Lakish thinks this, Reish Lakish must hold that the warning one can give just according to his, the warning only the man himself has to witness, that the warning, there was a machloket, whether the warning that a husband gives his wife, whether it needed two witnesses, is it just enough that the man himself is witnessing himself giving the warning? That, so apparently Reish Lakish holds that the warning doesn't need to be witnessed by anyone else, only by the man. And so what's gonna happen? If the man warns his wife and says, stay away from this guy, Kuli alma lo yada de kanela. Everyone else will not know that he has formally warned her. And so what's going to happen? When the woman suddenly stops spending time with them or suddenly starts acting differently towards these people that perhaps were in their community and starts distancing from herself from them, these other people aren't going to understand why. And so it's going to create a separation between her and the rest of her community. And then they're going to be angered and feel offended because they're not going to understand why all of a sudden her behavior has changed. The Amre, my dekama dekabale, they're going to say, what's happening that she's separating herself from us? And they're going to come to be angered with her. So he's saying, what's kinui, this warning that one has to give to their wife before the Sota ritual can practice? This warning is none other than rooted in anger. It's a thing that once you start, and it's not, he's not arguing, do the Sota ritual, but get rid of the warning. He's saying just even the warning itself is problematic. He's saying the warning itself is going to create distance and separation and anger between her and between other people in the community because they won't understand why all of a sudden she's starting to separate herself and distance herself from them. Rabbi Yemar says, what is this kinui? This kinui is something, Amar Devar Hamatil Kina Beino Lebeina. The kinui is something that causes this anger and this distance specifically between the husband and the wife. Whereas Reish Lakish said, between her and other people, bein alei bein acharim, he says, between the husband and the wife. How do we know this? Apparently, Rabbi Yemar holds that this kinui can only happen in the presence of two other witnesses. So, kuli alma yada de kanala. So everyone else will know that they'll understand why she's distancing herself from them because they'll have known that there was, oh, they'll be like, oh, so-and-so warns his wife. And so that's why all of a sudden she's acting differently. So Rabbi Yemar is not concerned about the anger distance it's going to cause between her and her community because everyone will know she's been formally warned. What's he concerned about? the ihu hu de atil ma'avid kinabahada. It's actually the husband who's going to come to act in anger with his wife, and vice versa, the wife who will come to act in anger with the husband. So whereas here, Reish Lakish is, both of them, Reish Lakish and Rav Yema, are saying this process of the warning of even beginning the first step of the sota ritual, while important, because at least it's preventing the husband from, in a wave of jealousy, from, you know, bringing her to the high priest, while important, he's saying even that first step of warning introduces distance and animosity, either between her and her community, because they're not going to understand why she's separating herself, or will introduce animosity into this relationship. The husband will come to act in anger with her. And while he doesn't say this explicitly, that the wife will then come to act in anger with the husband. And they're seeing the kinui, both of them, as being negative. And so, Alma kasvare de asor lekanot. And therefore, both of them, Rav Yemar and Reish Lakish, hold that it is forbidden to issue a warning. And if it's forbidden to issue a warning, it's also forbidden to then go forward with the sota ritual. So here we have this position in the Torah, we're being told, here's what you do if a husband subjects a wife to adultery. In the Mishnah, we're being told, well, if you're going to do it, you first have to have this process of warning. And then suddenly you have the voices of Reish Lakish and Rav Yemar saying, this is really going to be toxic and problematic for the community, problematic for their relationship. And we don't even want you doing this first step. Actually, the sota ritual as described from the Torah is forbidden. Even the first step, the kinui. Okay, let me pause there for a moment. Initial responses to seeing this material. What is the Gemara doing? Yeah, Alyssa, good morning.
Good morning. One question that I have here is, you know, one concern that I have potentially reading these texts is, yes, of course it's bad when these things get brought up and there's anger brought up in the public square. But what if it's worse not to have any way to address these grievances? The last thing that I would want is for people to turn that anger in on themselves. And so I guess that's the question. Does that make sense?
When you say turn the anger in on themselves, who are you referring to?
Either the wife or the husband. I think that I really appreciate this lens of saying, we don't want this warning because the warning leads to the ritual, and we don't want the ritual because mm-hmm. it's public, it's humiliating, you know, X, Y, Z reason. Mm-hmm. You know, if we don't have the sota ritual and we don't have the warning, that in the case that, you know, there is a real conflict in a relationship, is there any way to address that in mm-hmm. a healthy or productive way? Or right. is it just going to fester and, you know, have a culture of silence around it and no one will know, and then people continue suffering?
Right. So you're seeing the sota ritual, which this came up in the first class, the sota ritual, on one hand, there may be some things that we might find problematic about it, but on the other hand, is offering a way forward for when there is this suspicion in the relationship of a way to move through it, to address it.
Do the rabbis go on to offer, you know, another way to address these issues outside of the paradigm of the sota ritual entirely? And what could that look like?
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be nice, Alyssa. We don't see that of like, okay, well, if you're not going to do the sota ritual, here's what you should do. Interestingly, it is Reish Lakish, though, who says in a totally different context, he says, there's two different statements. I can't remember which one he's the author of, but he says either something like, there's no peace without tochacha, or there's no love without tochacha, one of those statements. But it's an amazing text on relationships, which is to say there can be no love or peace in relationships without both partners being willing and able to actually confront each other. So while Reish Lakish is not, that's not in the context of the sota ritual at all, Reish Lakish is actually a good source of relationship advice of saying real relationships require real work and real honesty. So he might be able to offer a path forward beyond the sota ritual. Alyssa, thanks for raising that. Amy, yes, good morning.
So I'm curious about why the sota ritual was originally, like, what it was responding to that it ended up in the Torah, and then what it is that the rabbis are now responding to, because I think that we frequently assume that the sota ritual is responding to female infidelity, that women are not being faithful, and therefore there needs to be a way to address that. But I wonder if actually it's responding to male violence and not to female infidelity at all. So yesterday I am involved with a community in Honduras, and I found out that a man had beaten his wife to death because he presumed that she had committed adultery. Now, nobody knows whether or not she did. And it's really irrelevant to me because that shouldn't get the death penalty. And, but it wasn't even about the adultery. It was just about his rage. That's what killed her, was his rage. And it feels to me that the Sota ritual, because it has so many steps and because there's that need to bring an offering and et cetera, that there's a control on his rage, that he has to take action, that actually perhaps this isn't about the woman at all, but it's actually about him and his inability to control himself, and that we're trying to control him. And just as often happens in patriarchy, in order to control men, we control women, which then this doesn't solve that problem. That if the issue is really a strife between, like an equal strife of some sort in a relationship, then maybe there's a better way to, you know, it's whatever. But if what we're trying to control is male violence towards women, then we actually do need a way to stop to kind of, yeah. So I'm curious where it actually starts. Where does it come from?
That's a really great question. I really appreciate you sharing sort of that real life, horrible real life event and the way in which you see it relating to the text. That framing of that, Amy, is a really good question. Everything you just said, I'm just echoing. You would assume it's responding to female infidelity, but if it's actually responding to male rage, then again, this is echoing what I think both what Alyssa was saying and what some people said in the first class, of actually there's maybe an unfortunate consequence of the Sota ritual might be that it's also controlling women, or there's a humiliating aspect for the woman, but that if it's coming from the necessity of providing some sort of outlet or control for male rage, of what the place there is. I just appreciate you raising that question. And in the sort of the piece that Midrash we're going to read later, I'll be interested to see where you see that in the piece and how you'll bring that back up. Richard, good morning.
Yeah, I mean, that was the point I was trying to articulate the other day, that I actually saw this Sota ritual in the Torah's mindset as a positive, as a way to prevent the male rage, also the woman shaming, that, you know, now if she has a child after this ritual, people will accept that she and the child are legit. And I think that's also important. It's still unfair. It's still, there's all these other problems and the rabbis don't necessarily help. But I do think there's a positive way to think of this in the, given the broader context they were already dealing with.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting question of if you think of it as responding to male rage, the need to, make sure that if there's a child born, that child will be seen as, you know, that the connection won't be challenged to the woman, will be seen as their child, that it won't be seen as sort of like a mumzer, it won't be seen as whatever the word is in English there. How would we rewrite the Sota ritual? Could we rewrite the Sota ritual to be simultaneously serving the purpose, but in a way that maybe had a less negative effect on the woman?
Well, or just what would happen if the Sota ritual was mutual, which the rabbis sort of do. They say it won't work if the man's not there, but that's still not really the same. But if the Torah had said, and if a woman is jealous of her husband, and again, it was different because they had allowed multiple wives, but, you know, if you could imagine an egalitarian Sota ritual, maybe, you know, we do have all these problems even today with people suspecting affairs, you know, and whatnot. Maybe it wouldn't be such a horrible way to think of it. I think the unfairness is that it's all so one-sided.
Yeah, I think that's right, Richard. Yeah. Okay, thank you for that. Let's go on a little bit more in the Gemara. Really appreciate these different perspectives on how the rabbis might understand the Sota ritual, how the Torah does, how we might understand it. And we're just going to skip a little bit here in the text. The school that Rabbi Yishmael taught, a man issues a warning to his wife, Ein adam yekneh liishto elim ken nichnasa bo ruach, shenemar ve'avar lav ruach kina v'kineh et ishto. My ruach. So Rabbi Yishmael says, a person only comes to warn his wife unless this spirit enters into him, as the Torah says, a ruach kinah, spirit of jealousy enters into him, and he gave warning to his wife or was jealous of his wife. And then they ask the question, my ruach, how do we understand this spirit? Now there's going to be a machloket. What do we mean by this ruach? Rabbanan amrei ruach tum'ah, a spirit of impurity enters into him. Rav Ashi amar ruach tahara, a spirit of purity enters into him. So there's two different ways of understanding this, ruach. And I think the way we understand this affects of how we understand the man's actions and whether or not he's acting from a place of righteousness. A spirit of purity rushes into him. And from this place of purity, in this righteousness that, you know, his wife should be faithful to him, he warns her. I think that makes the warning a bit different if it's coming from a place of tahara, of purity, versus if what happens is a ruach tum'ah, a spirit of impurity rushes into him. And then it's from this impurity, this sin that's have this jealousy, right? That jealousy becomes this impure emotion, this jealousy that's happening within him. It's from a ruach tum'ah. He sees by a ruach tum'ah that he comes to warn his wife. I think if we understand it as a ruach tum'ah that comes to take over him, it gives certainly, I think, like a negative valence to him performing, warning his wife and performing the ritual. Whereas if it's from a ruach tahara, a spirit of purity, it makes it seem as though the man is in the right, the man is righteous. So two very different understandings of what is it that takes hold of the man and causes him to then warn his wife. So then they're going to go and say, it stands to reason, like the one who says that Rabbi Yishmael was speaking of a spirit of purity. If we think that Rabbi Yishmael was speaking of a spirit of impurity, as is taught, and he warned his wife, that it would make sense that for that person, it would be reshut. It would be permitted to warn or not warn. If you think the spirit that rushes into him is a spirit tahara, right, then you would say, well, he can do it or he cannot do it. And that's the opinion of Rabbi Yishmael. Whereas Rabbi Akiva says it's mandatory, that you are in fact obligated to warn your wife. So then Gemara is going to go and say, if you're obligated to warn your wife, granted, if you say that Rabbi Yishmael was speaking of a spirit of purity, well, then it is well. It may be optional or even mandatory. Okay, if you understand Rabbi Yishmael is talking about ruach Torah, it makes sense that from that position of if it's a ruach Torah, spirit of purity, either a person could warn his wife, he could not, or it could be obligatory. But if you understand Rabbi Yishmael as talking about a spirit of impurity, that actually what happens is the man is seized by jealousy, is seized by a spirit of impurity. Could it be optional or mandatory for a person to introduce a spirit of impurity to himself? It's from, if you think it's from a ruach tum'ah, if you go with this rabbanan, what is the spirit that enters into him? It's a ruach tum'ah. Well, then suddenly it can't be that it's reshut, that it's permissible to warn your wife, or that it's even chovah, God forbid, obligatory to warn your wife, because we would never want a ruach tum'ah to enter into someone. If you believe that it's what is the spirit that comes over him, it's the spirit of impurity, that there's something wrong with the man, well, then that's going to match up with a position like Reish Lakish or Rav Yemar that's going to say, we don't actually want this going forward. It's actually going to be forbidden to warn your wife. So the question here is already the rabbis are seeing, when a man comes to warn his wife, what is the position from which he's doing it? Is it from a place of purity within himself or a place of impurity with himself? And then how does that impact how we see his action? If it's a place of impurity, then maybe we say, oh yeah, the ritual is either reshut, it's permissible, or obligatory. But if we think it's a ruach tum'ah, well, then we're going to have to come to a position like Reish Lakish or Rav Yemar, where we say, actually, this is a sore and we don't want people that are doing this. Let's just, we'll finish out the Gemara a little bit. Then it's going to spell out these two separate positions that we just saw. The kineti shto reshut divrei Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Akiva merchova, that he warned his wife, according to Rabbi Yishmael, this is permissible, meaning he could do it or he could not do it. He has the choice. That's Rabbi Yishmael's position. Rabbi Akiva says it's chova, that a person is actually obligated to. If a person suspects his wife, if a man suspects his wife of cheating, he's obligated to warn her and to therefore trigger the ritual into coming to effect. So we've now seen three different positions. We saw the position of Rav Yemar and Reish Lakish that were afraid of kina, were afraid of anger and distancing. And they said it is a sore, it is forbidden to warn one's wife. We see now Rabbi Yishmael, well, maybe because we assume it's a spirit of purity that enters the man. So we're saying, according to Rabbi Yishmael, it would be reshut. Either a person can do it or not do it. And now we're going to hear of the position of Rabbi Akiva, again, we have to assume that Rabbi Akiva's position that one is obligated to warn their wife if they suspect them can only align with a reading of Ruach, where the spirit that enters into him is one of Tohara, is purity. Because if it was a spirit of impurity, then you could never get to a position where one is obligated. So we see that even amongst the rabbis, there's great diversity of, is it forbidden to trigger this ritual? Is it permitted to trigger this ritual? Or are you in fact chayav? So how do we understand the reasoning of Rabbi Yishmael? How does Rabbi Yishmael get to a position of permitted? It could go either way. He holds in accordance with the teacher of this statement as it's taught. Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov says, with regard to that which the Torah says, Lo tisna d'achicha b'yavavecha, don't hate your fellow in your heart. Yechol kagon zeh. Could it be that when the Torah is so amazing, could it be that when the Torah says, don't hate your fellow in your heart, could it even be talking about the circumstance of the sota, that we don't want the man to hate the wife in his heart? And so therefore, could it be that the commandment to not hate your fellow in the heart would be a commandment against forbidding the husband from performing the sota ritual on his wife and making it forbidden? Could it be that this verse is even coming to include even a man who suspects his wife of adultery, he shouldn't come to hate her in his heart and trigger the sota ritual? Tamu lomar, the Torah teaches, ve'avar lav ruach kino v'kinei dishto. No, the Torah specifically comes to say, lest you think that this verse, don't hate the fellow in your heart, is coming to include even in the case of a man who suspects a wife of cheating, and so therefore he shouldn't perform the sota ritual on her. The Torah then gives explicit permission and says the man may come to warn his wife and ultimately put her through the ritual. And so Rabbi Yishmael understands it might have been that our impulse was to say the sota ritual is forbidden, it's not a good idea, but the Torah gives a specific permission to say one could do it or one could not do it. I think the reason why Rabbi Yishmael doesn't come to say it's chovah like Rabbi Akiva is because he's still holding this, well, but what about lo tisna d'achicha b'yavavecha, don't hate the fellow in your heart. That it's sort of too much of a swing to go from don't hate the fellow in your heart to, yeah, you're absolutely obligated to subject your wife to the sota ritual. And so the balance is, well, it does seem like the warning of the sota ritual introduces sort of a hate and anger into one's heart, but the Torah, it seems to be giving us permission, v'kinei tishto, and so we're going to make it reshut permissible. Whereas for Rabbi Akiva, who gets to the position that it is chovah, that in fact one is obligated to warn one's wife, how does he get there? Kinui acharina kativ. He says, the reason why he says that it is, one is obligated is because the warning, it speaks of the warning, the kine happening twice. Where does it say that in the verses? There is another warning written in the same verse as the entire verse reads, and the spirit of jealousy came upon him and he warned his wife and she be defiled. That's the first time he warned his wife, or if the spirit of jealousy came upon him and he warned his wife and she not be defiled. We read that really it's talking about two separate circumstances. Either she really did do it and he warned her, or she really didn't do it and he warned her. But what Rabbi Akiva is reading it is the fact that it mentions the warning happening twice. That means the first time is to say you were permitted. The second time is to really drive home the warning and say, no, you are in fact obligated to warn your wife. I bring all this just to sort of spell out again what we're seeing is that we go from the Torah, where I didn't ask you this question, but there could be the question of, do you see the Torah is talking about the sota ritual as descriptive or prescriptive, meaning descriptive, this is what was happening. This is what, you know, when one suspects his wife, this is what people were doing, versus prescriptive of, you have to do this. If one suspects one's wife, this is what one has to do. The Mishnah, where I think that there is a tension in the Mishnah of, on one hand, we want to make it harder, but on the other hand, there's sort of a deepening or expanding of the public nature, some of the humiliation of the ritual. And in the Gemara, even just amongst the rabbis, forget getting to like modern feminist commentary on it, there's a real diversity of how we're seeing the sota ritual. Are we seeing the sota ritual as written by the Torah, as encoded by the Mishnah, as ultimately something that is forbidden to do because of the anger and distance it introduces? Are we seeing it as something that's permitted to do? But we feel a tension with that because we recognize that by by triggering the sota ritual, it may be intention with lo tisnat achicha bilavecha. It might be intention with this hate being in someone's heart, or maybe we're seeing this as a way of moving past that, right? We're afraid of the hate being in the heart, and the sota ritual is the way to move forward. Or do we see the ritual as we are sticking with this ritual as prescribed in the Torah? And Rabbi Akiva saying, you know, you're in fact, even if you don't want to do it, even if you suspect your wife and you're uncomfortable with the ritual, you are in fact obligated to warn her and to trigger it. How do we know this? Because that warning is written twice in the Torah. Okay, let me pause there. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts and responses, just seeing sort of the diversity of the positions laid out in the Gemara, either just your responses. Are you surprised by seeing these different positions? What of this sort of makes sense to you? And I'll say, to me, it feels very powerful that this conversation is happening on the very first daf. This is the very first sugya of an entire Masechet. The Masechet's going to go on. It's many, many, many pages. But that in an entire Masechet, you would have thought, oh, there's an entire Masechet that's attributed to the Sota ritual. They must really be into it. And that even in the opening pages of the Masechet, you could see the rabbis are landing in really different places about how we even feel about this ritual as laid out by the Torah. Yeah. Hannah, please. And then Amy.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that there are some rabbis who are acknowledging that it can be a very emotionally damaging ritual, but they don't explicitly acknowledge that from the woman's perspective. They talk about anger between her and other members of the community or between her and her husband, but there does seem to be an acknowledgement by those particular rabbis that, yeah, that it's not necessarily a good thing, which feels pretty radical. As I said earlier, this is a ritual which is described in the Torah. So for them to say, maybe not, it was quite a radical position for them to take.
Yeah. Thank you, Hannah. Amy, yeah.
So I have a personality question with these rabbis. How many of them were living with their wives? Do you know? I mean, I just don't know this. Who was saying it's obligated? Who was saying it's not obligated? Was living with a wife who they might have gone home and chatted with over dinner about the Sota ritual and gotten their feedback from?
That's a really great question. I don't know the answer to that question, but like that would be an amazing thing to, we'd have to map out from other stories in the Gemara to figure out how that might be into play. I mean, I will say we skipped a bit in the Gemara by Rabbi Meir, where Rabbi Meir basically, he's, I think, reinforcing the importance of the Sota ritual. He says, a person commits transgressions in private and the Holy One proclaims about him openly. The things we do privately, the Holy One will make known. And the proof text that's bringing for that is the Sota ritual, that meaning like the cheating happens in secret and then it's made public. So I would assume from that, that Rabbi Meir is in support of the Sota ritual of like all those dirty things you do will be found out. And I mean, we do know a little bit about Rabbi Meir's relationship with Broria, of being a very strong partner that he would have been talking to. So that's a small indicator, but I don't know, Amy, that's an amazing question that we'd have to do more learning on. Yeah, Chana and then Ronnie.
It doesn't really surprise me that Rabbi Akiva was the one who came up with this. Certainly Rabbi Meir, because of his relationship with women, but Rabbi Akiva left his wife destitute, never visited her, left his wife, and then the only value she had was for what she did for him and his students. I mean, she was treated like crap. So it's like, not that, I mean, it tells you something about the way men or the way these rabbis thought about women kind of generally. And so it really didn't surprise me that he was the one who was most interested in accusing the woman.
That's interesting, bringing into the Rabbi Akiva's, you know, he went off to learn, but his separation for 20, then 40 years from his wife. Again, Amy, I think it's a really interesting question. Yeah. I think it's a really interesting question to think about. And also I'd sort of want to see, now I want to see, Amy, the Midrashim that you would write of the men going home and being in conversation with their wives about the Sota ritual. Ronnie, please.
I have a question and a comment. I guess my comment is, I'm always blown away by how incredibly obsessional these rabbis were among themselves concerning everything that had to do with women. It's extraordinary, but I think they were also very bothered by this in the way that we are in modern times. And so my question is, do we have any sense how frequently the ritual was actually practiced and and put into effect? Is there any, I mean, historically, anthropologically, is it something that was very common and therefore the rabbis were so troubled over it? Or is it just they're picking up on one detail yet again that has to do with relationships between men and women? And before you try and answer, I just thought I'd share with people. I learned just this morning from an Israeli friend that in modern Hebrew, the word sota means perverted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it has certainly come down as condemning women, I guess, condemning adulterous women.
That's a good question, Ronnie. We had that question on Monday also of how much was this ritual really in practice. I think that there is some writing on it. I don't think that there are conclusive answers to that, whether this sort of falls in the category of thing that wasn't in practice or things that were, I don't know that it, I probably would lean away from it being like heavily practiced, but I don't really know whether it was rarely practiced or somewhat practiced. I did mention just, you know, at the end of the last session, and you have this on your source sheet today, that there is the text of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai eventually eradicating the sota ritual and saying, like, I'm not going to punish the daughters if the men are also cheating. But the fact that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has to eradicate the ritual, it sounds like the ritual must have been somewhat being practiced. But I don't actually know more firsthand. The other thing I'll just say is that the rabbis obsess over everything. They don't just obsess over women and the sota ritual and whether or not, even if we assume that the ritual wasn't actually being practiced, how it should be practiced hypothetically, keeping in mind that so much of the Gemara is the rabbis obsessing over things relating to the temple, which we know weren't in practice because the temple had been destroyed, and yet they're still really invested in the question of, well, how would we do it or what would happen? And so whether or not the sota ritual was practiced is an important and interesting question, but it doesn't surprise me that even if it wasn't in practice, that the rabbis would still be really invested in, is this a good thing? What is the effect of it? How should it be practiced? Because that's what they do. They play out those hypotheticals. We've been looking at that. We've been reading the Mishnah and the Gemara in a way as a form of Midrash on the Torah, in the sense of Midrash as interpretation and commentary. And what are the questions of the Torah that the Mishnah and the Gemara are coming to respond to? How is it expanding and elucidating? I now want to share with you a script that I wrote. This is, we're reading an excerpt of the script. It's actually, I don't know, something like 10 scenes long. We're only reading two or three scenes of it together. But it's a script that I wrote that is collaging, that's functioning as midrash on the sota ritual, and is going to collage together the voices of the Torah, the Mishnah, and then modern feminist writings on gender, sex, and power. I think, I'm pretty sure that all of the words that are in the script that are being spoken are not my words. They're all found text. The stage directions are my words. They're all found text, and you'll see in the footnotes, I'm citing where the texts are coming from. And part of the creation of this is the belief for me, I do find the sota ritual, both I really appreciate how some people are speaking to sort of the perhaps the necessity and the role of the sota ritual, especially Amy, your perspective on responding to male rage and what would happen if we didn't have the sota ritual. I really appreciate those perspectives. And at the same time, I find the ritual troubling. And so for me, my way of responding to difficult texts is rather than turning away from them is to turn into them and to want to weave, as someone said so beautifully in a class that I was teaching this morning, to weave myself and weave my voices into the text. And the way to do that was to put the Torah and the Mishnah in conversation with my own voice and in conversation with the voices of other writers that I was thinking about. And so that's part of what this collage script is. So we're jumping into what would be scene three in the script. All the key players are already in place, including the husband, the two writers, and the crowd of men. A second woman enters the stage and stands far downstage left. Just to say, it's already been established in the first two scenes, writer number one, all the language of writer number one comes from the Torah, and all the language of writer number two comes from the Mishnah. So when you see writer number one, you're reading direct Torah, and when you see writer number two, you're reading directly from the Mishnah. So a second woman enters the stage and stands far downstage left.
This book is indeed about words, speaking the unspoken, speaking the spoken in a new and viable way, speaking the pain, speaking the hunger, speaking.
From here on, Voice of Woman 2 will contain the words from the introduction of Eve Ensler's A Memory, A Monologue, A Rant, and A Prayer.
If jealousy overcomes him,
the husband takes two steps towards the sota.
They threaten her. They say things to her that are not fit for her to hear.
The men point their fingers at the sota in accusation.
Speaking about violence against women, not because it is the only issue, but because it is an issue that lives smack in the middle of the world and is still not spoken, not seen, not given weight or significance, so that words can crack open.
The priest makes her stand before the Lord.
The priest places both hands on the sota's hips and lifts her onto the milk crate.
So that the words crack open numbness and denial and disassociation and distance and deception. Speaking so that we are in community, in conscience.
He tears her garments. He uncovers her breasts.
He rips off her dress and uncovers her hair.
In concern.
They watch.
Speaking about violence against women, because in 2006, young Amish girls are gunned down in their school just because they are girls. Women are trafficked like meat, sold from poor neighborhoods to men in rich neighborhoods. Women are raped in Darfur on their way to get wood for the fire or grass for their donkeys.
May the Lord make you a curse. The priest lowers his hands on the sota's body, placing one hand behind the small of her back and one hand over her stomach. May you miscarry.
In 2006, women are burned and mutilated and stoned and dismissed and undone and refused and silenced.
She says, amen, amen.
Speaking about violence, because in early November 2006, the president of Israel stepped down after being accused of rape and harassment, and a cleric in Australia blamed uncovered women for getting raped.
Sota lifts her eyes to the audience and looks at the husband. She nods almost imperceptibly. She casts her eyes down to the ground. He makes her drink. The priest bends down and lifts the glass of water from the table. He stirs the water with the spoon. He tips the sota's head back and forces her to drink.
Speaking about violence against women because of your mother, your sister, your aunt, your daughter, your girlfriend, your best friend, your wife. Speaking about violence against women because the story of women is the story of life itself. In speaking about it, you cannot avoid speaking about racism and domination, poverty and patriarchy, empire building, war, sexuality, desire, imagination. The mechanism of violence is what destroys women, controls women, diminishes women, and keeps them in their so-called place.
They watch.
They watch.
The crowd takes a step back and watches with interest, waiting to see the results of the trial. Nothing happens.
Speaking about violence, telling the stories, because in the telling, we legitimize women's experience. We reveal what is happening in the dark, in the basement, out of sight. In the telling, women take their power back, their voice, their remembering, their future.
The crowd continues to watch. Woman too turns her eyes to the sota. The husband stands in silence, lights out. Scene 4. Female voiceover, it begins again, lights up. All the key players are already in place, including the husband, the two writers, the crowd of men and woman too. A third woman enters the stage and walks towards the sota. She stands on the edge of the crowd.
This book is indeed about words.
Jealousy overcomes him. The husband takes two steps towards the sota.
Speaking the unspoken, speaking the pain.
Who are you and whom do you love?
From here on, the Voice of Woman 3 will contain the words of Bana Kapil Rides, the vertical interrogation of strangers.
They threaten her.
The men point their fingers at the sota in accusation.
How will you begin? How will you live now?
The priest makes her stand before the Lord. The priest places both hands on the sota's hips and lifts her onto the milk crate.
What is the shape of your body?
He tears her garments. He uncovers her breasts.
He rips off her dress and uncovers her hair.
Who was responsible for the suffering of your mother?
They watch.
May the Lord make you a curse. May you miscarry. The priest lowers his hands on the woman's body, placing one hand behind the small of her back and one hand over her stomach.
Who are you and whom do you love?
She says, "Amen, amen."
What are the consequences of your silence?
The sota lifts her eyes to the audience and looks at the husband. She nods almost imperceptibly. She casts her eyes down to the ground. Drink. The priest bends down and lifts the glass of water from the table. He stirs the water with a spoon. He tips the woman's head back and forces her to drink. A fourth woman enters the stage and stands a distance away.
They watch. Tell me what you know about dismemberment.
The crowd takes a step back and watches with interest, waiting to see the result of the trial. Nothing happens.
Who are you and whom do you love?
The crowd waits eagerly in silence.
There was a woman here who was loved. She was good to look at because she is a quick and imaginative thinker. She liked the view of the peach orchard from the southern window and loved the turquoise earrings that her mother had given her at her marriage. Her life mattered utterly to herself, to her children, to those she loved, to the birds she scattered crumbs to after the family had eaten. This was her house, and years later the house still remembered her, though it was almost gone and the woman's spirit had flown to the other side.
From here on, the voice of woman four comes from the words of Joy Harjo's poem, There's No Such Thing as a One-Way Land Bridge, from her book, A Map to the Next World. Woman four continues to look at the sota, lights out. So that's just an excerpt. We're going to stop there. The way that the script works is that you can see what's already started happening and what's going to keep happening is that in scenes one and two that we didn't read, we establish the voice of writer one, which is the Torah, and sort of this moving through the motions of the ritual that's being performed, of the priest subjecting the woman to it, the priest lifting her onto the crate, the woman nodding imperceptibly, the husband standing in silence, and her being made to drink. And that action just keeps happening over and over in each of the scenes. And then in each of the scenes, these voices of women that are being given over through different texts keep being layered in, and scene by scene, more and more female voices are coming to stand around her. So physically what you would be seeing on stage is you started off with the woman and the husband, and then you added in writer one, the Torah, you added in the Mishnah, you added in the crowd of men, and then slowly each scene we're adding in another woman, another woman, another woman, another woman, and they're bringing their voices and they're bringing these different stories in the forms of these different texts. The closing moment of the piece is sort of this climactic moment of you've now heard all these women's voices sort of offering support and voice and experience in different ways. And the final moment of the piece is that the sota opens her mouth to speak. And that's when it's a blackout. So we don't actually get to hear if she speaks and what she speaks. My thinking there was that we're going back to what we talked about on Monday, is part of what for me is hard about the sota ritual is her passivity and that she's not given a voice, and that the one moment of voice she's given is a voice that she's forced to say. She's forced to say amen and to say amen to someone else's words. She nods her head. She's submitting herself to the ritual, but is it a voluntary submission? And sort of the structure of the piece is to not only be putting the Torah and the Mishnah in conversation with these modern writings, but to be bringing in these female voices of support and experience and story to ultimately, hopefully, be giving the sota enough space where she will open her mouth to speak. But again, the question is, does she speak, and what would she say? So I'm gonna, I'll stop there. I'm curious to hear your this is just the excerpt, but to hear your responses to it, of what you feel, if we treat this text as a midrash, of what do you feel this midrash, what questions is this responding to, what issues are responding to, what do you feel like it's sort of bringing or adding to the Torah, to the Mishnah, to the Gemara. Dina, hi.
I think it's fascinating. I'd love to read the whole thing. I think it would be a wonderful midrash or one to work on. But I think it requires what we've already done on the first session and this session. And then this would be the third. I'm not sure that I could appreciate it if I didn't have the background you've given us in these two former ones. Now, having had these two, it makes me really eager to be a part of the play.
if we ever go forward with it, Dina, I'll call you first.
Thank you.
Richard, yeah.
Very powerful. I'm sure you have a lot of other sources, but for me, one of the main sources, sort of starting to understand some of the spousal abuse or male abuse like this, is actually Trevor Noah's autobiography, where his mother was a victim. And when you talk about the woman being silenced, one of the points that he makes in the book is that every time she would be abused and the police came, they encouraged her not to file a report because it would get him in trouble, create all kinds of problems. And then when he finally shoots her, he goes into court and says, it was my first offense. I just got a little emotional this one time. And he got a very light sentence. And so that really hit hard when you're talking here about the silence that's involved.
Thank you, Richard. Hannah, and then Rabbi Sharon.
Very powerful, slightly emotional at the moment. Something that really hit me about it was the repeated "they watches" from the writer one and writer two figure, them sort of by them, the fact that they're kind of by themselves and sort of this repeated they watch kind of, for me anyway, kind of felt like it was always calling out the passivity of the male crowd around the SOTA, the fact they are merely watching and they're not intervening, not supporting her, not protecting. Yeah, the lack of action on behalf of the SOTA.
Yeah, that's I think I feel that in the writer one and writer two, sort of the distance of like, we're just the writers, we're just the text, and also the crowd of like the crowd of onlookers who are sort of, I guess for those of you who are there for the Nadav and Avihu script, there's a sort of a similarity there of like the role of the onlookers in either encouraging or sort of supporting or passively supporting, or that curiosity of like, what's the energy of that Greek chorus there of the men that are watching, of the women that are just gathering around. I guess part of what I was doing now that I think about it in the script is that I have the men as the onlookers, whereas the Mishnah seemed to have the women, sort of the women watching her, but it feels like there could potentially be I don't really know what you imagine the women who are the onlookers in the Mishnah, the women of this script, rather than just be sort of the curious onlookers of this other woman's downfall, they become the supportive body of helping to support her. Okay, Rabbi Sharon, yeah, please.
Thank you, Rabbi Avi. It's a very powerful midrash. I was just wondering just a comment about the staging and then another comment. The comment about the staging is, I'm wondering if we all had, was all female voices, and I'm wondering if the Torah voice and if the Mishnah voice had been a male voice, it feels like that would be, might be more, not that the Torah was written by a man, but the Mishnah certainly was. And it just feels like that might be something that might to consider. Just that was just a staging thing that I noticed. The other thing, and having read it, I mean, I've always felt this way, but having heard this read, how it's so descriptive. How is this in any way supposed to make the relationship between the husband and the wife better? Right? Because that's a lot of what the SOTA ritual is. Well, let's clear the air. This way he's got his jealous rage. We'll show you how she hasn't done anything. It clears the air. And then she's able to get pregnant and everything is jolly good. And just to it never felt that that was, it didn't felt like that that made sense. And having read or heard your midrash performed, it really feels like, how is this supposed to make things better between them?
Yeah, I appreciate that. To both of your comments, to imagining writer one and writer two as being read by male voices, when I've had this reading in the past, that's something that I've really struggled with. I do think in my head, I want them to be male voices because I hear the Torah and the Mishnah as being those male patriarchal voices. And I've also, for the people who are in this room, who don't identify as women, I've struggled with that impulse of really then locking male audiences into that oppressive role of what does it mean to force the male voices as readers to be in a role that they might not want to be in, and that the only place of supporting in this piece is really focusing on the women, but sort of locking men into that role feels problematic, but also very much the way that I see the piece being read and performed. Rabbi Sharon, what was the second thing you said? I wanted to respond to that also.
The SOTA ritual is supposed to help
relationship
between the husband and the wife. It feels like it does exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and that was, yes, I very much felt that too. I wrote this haiku once about it. I went through a period of writing haikus on the Torah, and the haiku was imagining the drive ride home from the SOTA ritual. Like, what do they say to her? What do they say to each other? What does that silence feel like? And I think that's part of what, I'm not totally sure what I imagine when she looks at the husband and she nods imperceptibly to him, but like, what is that moment of he's standing there silently and she looks at him? I don't know. I think a lot could be contained by that. I think it could be a look of accusation or blame. I think it also could be a look of, if this is what you need me to go through in order for us to be able to move forward, then I guess I'll give this to you. But why is this what you need me to go through? And then how do you recover from that in a relationship?
So descriptive when it says he pulls her hair back and forces her to drink. It's
it's so violent. And it just, I imagine her saying, if this is what you need me to do to be the good wife, this is not for me. But I realize in the times of the Bible and the times of the Talmud, women didn't have those options. That was the, that was part of the tragedy.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm finding myself wanting to bring together all kinds of different characters and all kinds of different times and texts. And so I want Judah and Tamar. I'm curious if you have them in here anywhere, but I want Judah and Tamar to be part of the story now and have her reaction and his reaction. And maybe he's one of the people, one of the male voices who actually stands with the Sota, having learned something from his experience with Tamar.
That's amazing, Amy. I mean, all the voices that come in are voices that are there are no like other biblical characters or rabbis' wives or anyone like sort of real characters, so to speak, that make it in. They're all the voices embodying text. But that is actually very powerful to imagine what would happen if like Tamar came to stood up and what would she say? And if you had Judah coming in to say she's more righteous than me cutting in, it's very powerful to imagine a version of the script. This was a version of the script that was focusing on the female voices as supports, but like, what are the other ways in which the script could go? We're like, okay, we need to focus on the female voices because there are none. But then once we have them, what does it look like to actually, that would be such a powerful line of Torah to cut in to actually have the male voice offering support in that way. Thank you for that beautiful suggestion. Alicia, hi.
I really appreciate how you've placed these different sources in conversation. And I think the way that you have placed them really highlights how, so I think we tend to look at ancient sources with a bit of an eye of superiority. And sometimes we think, oh, they were so misogynist back then and we've improved so much. But the way that you've placed these sources, especially with the Eve Ensler and with the other modern writings, really shows us how this thread of violence against women has continued and has not changed as much as we would like. So I think you did that really beautifully. And a second point that I was just thinking about, the violence is horrifying, especially how we see how it's escalated to the uncovering and the rending of the clothes and the undoing of the hair. It often seems to me like the rabbis are trying to figure out ways to live within the way that society was at the time. And they're trying to live in the world as it is. And I wonder if they are seeing this very real problem of male anger, and in enacting this anger in a safe way, in public. Someone had made a comment that at least she's not dead. And if they are, you know, exercising the husband's anger in a public, safe way that will allow it to diffuse in a way that protects her life. And I still find it horrifying, but, you know, I'm also considering that angle.
Thank you, Alicia, for that. Ronnie and Dina.
Well, first of all, I want to say amen to what you just put forward, Rabbi Avi. And as a teacher and a writer, though, I want to express how disturbing I find this. And its strength, of course, comes from how disturbing it is. But I wonder if you're really putting this forward as a text that will illuminate these issues for us, to think about the intention of the ways in which it disturbs. For example, it's very powerful that the lights go down when the Sota is just about to speak, but I want to hear from her and I need to hear from her. And it isn't just enough, I think, that we hear Eve Ensler or all the women through the ages, which make it very depressing in a certain way. And some of the echoes for me were thinking about the role of all the witnesses, because there's also a voyeuristic quality. I was thinking about people who would come out to see lynchings. It became almost a form of public entertainment. And I think that's very, very disturbing and potentially dangerous in the sense of what you want these witnesses to really be doing for us, trying to make sense of this sota now. And the other resonance for me was a scene in The Merchant of Venice. I don't know if people who know it, after Portia has told Shylock he's not getting his pound of flesh, and above and beyond that, he has to convert. And then she says, "Art thou content, Jew?" Well, what on earth is he supposed to say to that? And similarly, for the sota, the fact that in the Torah she only says amen, amen, I want to hear her voice at the end. I don't know, you're the writer, I don't know what you would have her say, but that's my reaction to how strong her continued silence was. So yeah. Thank you.
I hear that very much, Ronnie. I don't know. I wrestled with the ending a lot. I knew the whole piece was about building to her voice and bringing in other voices. I wrestled with the ending of, does she actually speak? And what is she? I think she actually, it ends by her taking an intake of air. So it's clear she's about to speak. In part, it might've been a cop-out on my part because I didn't actually know what she would have said. And I think it would have been maybe a moment where I had to find the words myself instead of using someone else's words. So I don't know if it was, I can argue it both ways. I'm not sure if it was, I didn't know what she would say, and so I didn't write it. Or what I would say, like, to defend myself, but I don't know if I'm just defending that I didn't have the answer, is that I like the potential that there could be a lot of different things she would say and a lot of different stories that could come out of her mouth, because she's actually representing not just the sota, but the archetype of so many women who have been silenced. And part of the reason why I felt like I couldn't come up with a thing she would say is because there's so many different women she's standing behind. By leaving it open, it allows those different voices.
All of our voices, really.
So I think it's a complicated end. I don't know how I feel about it, and I very much hear where you're pushing me. Thank you. Dina and then Hannah, please.
Your final statement, I just wanted to affirm that you said before, not, don't turn away, turn towards Torah and try to figure out instead of just leaving. But then thinking about the ending that we were just talking about, I love that it stops where it stops. And I see it as the stepping stone to the continuing conversation. So when the sota speaks, it can be me, it can be you, it can be him, you know. So I think that, you know, that's the point you've brought us to in the story, in the skit. And that then the conversation starts. And so that's what I would see happening. The sota has to speak for everybody. Well, you know, everybody's story is different, and let's do our stories then. So that's what I would like to happen with it. I thought it was interesting about even the story of the witness. You know, someone could say, I witnessed this happen and I didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. As a real story, you know, so I think it provokes all those things. And this is just a tiny thing, but whether it's a male or female reader, I don't think that should matter. I don't think to attempt to have the male reader be the male, what's the male? I don't think that's important. It shouldn't even enter in to the discussion.
Tina, thank you so much for all that. And I love that this has never actually been like performed on a stage. And I think part of it, I see it always as being sort of in a workshop mode of first learning the Torah, first learning the text as we did, then having the reading of the script, then talking about it. And so, Dina, what I love about what you just said is that the script is actually just then the beginning of the conversation, in which if it was in workshop format, the script ends, and that's where our individual stories of the people reading it begin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dina. Yeah, Hannah, hi.
So I was uncharacteristically quiet during this because I literally was shaking. I mean, my palms started sweating, and it just was so wrenching. You know, the thing about her not being dead, so at least that's okay, makes me feel like, you know, humiliation is considered like a kind of death. I mean, it's like killing somebody. So her life is so damaged and rent after this that I'm not sure she's really that alive after this. I mean, I don't know how somebody could live with that kind of humiliation. And so what Ronnie said about the lynching and people finding it entertaining, my association was, you know, women were considered crazy if they veered a little bit away from how the norms of women were supposed to be, and whether if they were accused of something, they were considered insane. So I thought about the same idea of, you know, there was that hospital, Bethlehem Hospital, it was called Bedlam in the, and I think it was in the 19th century, but they used to have this little like hole in the wall. And if you paid a quarter, you can go in and look at the lunatics. I mean, it was a kind of entertainment. So that's what made me think of the women. And then, and then I also thought of Shakespeare. That's why I said that I wish you were my friend, because you know, that this is a dramatization of something. I thought of Measure for Measure. At the end of Measure for Measure, after this entire thing where Angelo is accusing Isabella, who's this virtuous woman, and he's accusing, at the end, the happy ending was that she's silent. I mean, it works out. She's not killed or anything, but she's quiet. I mean, you never hear from her again. And that's kind of a typical happy ending in Shakespeare. In the comedies, is that nobody dies. Great, nobody dies, but the woman never talks again. And finally, one more point. You said in the last session that I had with you, we talked about Lilith and reclaiming and all of that. And I thought there is a point where reclaiming is overrated. You know, we're not reclaiming the Sota so much. There are some things that are beyond the pale. We can't make anything out of this. It's just this tragic thing that exists. It's one of the vagaries of our tradition. And I thought about that idea of Midrash is sometimes really intellectual, but this one is like literally embodied. It's like brought into the body. It's you can feel it. I mean, my hands are sweating, I told you. It's like, you know, the idea of Midrash not, you know, taking it out of the intellectual and turning it into something that like literally shakes you is really powerful. And that's why drama is the perfect vehicle for this. So I just want to thank you, even though it was very painful, I thank you for that kind of pain, which was really enlightening. So
thank you, Hannah, for all of those thoughts. I can't respond to all of them, but just to offer a lot of appreciation for all of them. I just was learning in the Eish Kodesh, Rabbi Kolon Miskalman Shapira, who was writing during the Warsaw Ghetto, in a totally different context, having nothing to do with Sota, he was talking about the importance of embodiment of ritual and embodiment of prayer and action. And the language he uses is that the goal is that we should make ourselves into bodies of Torah. And then he later in the same drasha says bodies of compassion. And so I just love thinking about what would it mean to make ourselves into a body of Torah or a body of compassion, and thinking about that, Hannah, with what you're saying. Amy, hi.
Hey, I just want to clarify. I'm not saying at least she's not dead. I'm saying if that's the goal, then the question is different. If the goal is for her to not be dead, then the contemporary response is different than if the goal is to figure out whether or not she's committed adultery. That's what I'm saying. And I'll, you know, add to that, I have also a JD. So I have a background in law. And when laws are created, they're created in response to something that's actually happening in society. If nobody put an aerosol can in the fire, there's no clause on the aerosol can that says, don't throw it in the fire. It happens because something happened. So that's what I'm saying. Not that, at least she's not dead, not that at all, because God forbid this should happen to anybody, but rather that if our goal is for her to not be killed, and if what we need to do for her not to be killed is to deal with male rage, then that's a whole, then in a contemporary question, we need a whole different way of addressing male rage and violence against women, because putting the burden on her is not the way to have her not be dead. So that's what I, just to clarify.
Thank you for clarifying that. And also, I just want to echo, like, I really appreciate the context that you're saying that the law, the where you're thinking about in terms of the law, that laws are not created unless there's a thing that happens. But I just thought your question, that framing, was so smart and so powerful of what is the sota ritual responding from, and imagining it responding to male rage instead of female infidelity actually does really give a different perspective of it. And I do love the idea that as people are leaving, there's a board with an invitation for people to write their own story. That's a really, and that's the voice of the sota. That's a brilliant idea. I just want to thank you really for this 2-day session. I think that the sota material can be challenging and potentially triggering material. I think certainly the way that I put the material in relationship with just even the beginnings that you're seeing, some of the texts that we're seeing, Eve Ensler's texts, juxtaposing exactly as Alicia was saying, part of what I think I was doing is saying these texts are not texts that are forgotten in the past, but actually we're still seeing these voices today, and we're seeing this violence against women playing out today in different ways, the silencing of women, the need to raise up women's voices. I think that this material is hard and painful. Wrenching, as Hannah put it, material. And so I want to thank you for jumping into that and for the vulnerability there and the bravery there. If you're interested in the full script, I'm happy to send it. I don't have it like at this exact second in the PDF format to share. If you want to, just email me at strasburg@hadar.org, and then I'll wait to see who wants it, and I'll send it all in an email at some point later tonight or tomorrow morning. I'm happy to share that with you. But really what I just want to say is thinking about this midrash as a whole, for those of you that have been in a few classes with me, you're hearing this in different ways. You know, I think specifically with this material, with the sota material, this could be material that would be really, for me, could be really alienating. And especially the Mishnah's treatment of the material, I find could be really alienating. And what midrash is for me, and what the script was for me, is really a stepping forward, an invitation to bring my voice to the table and insert my voice into the conversation, and insert not only my voice, but the voices of other women and the other thinkers into the conversation. And instead of rejecting this material, but to say like, what can happen when we bring this material in conversation with topics, things that we're still struggling with today, we're still wrestling with gender and power and sex and violence against women. And so rather than say this material in the Torah or this treatment of women in the Mishnah makes me uncomfortable, well, it's actually still uncomfortable today. And so what happens if we bring all these texts in conversation together? Can we have a productive conversation about it? Can we learn something? Can we hold these texts up to our society today as a mirror? And what would we learn about ourselves? And what do we learn about the Torah? And to really see midrash and to see texts in which we may not have initially seen our voices, to see it as an opportunity and even a calling and even a chovah, as an obligation to weave our own voices into the work. So again, I really want to thank you for joining me on that, wishing you whatever release you need from this and bringing yourself forward into the rest of your day and your week. Yasher koach.